So, hello everyone, good evening. Great to see such an audience. My fundamental question here is going to be, what is the nature of reality? And it's a question that can be answered in lots of different ways. So I'm going to explore and compare the different approaches of physics and Buddhism. So as Rusra Khetu said, when I was a child and teenager, I was fascinated by physics and the way it explained the world, the objective world, and came up with some surprising ideas about it. And I'm now fascinated by Buddhism, particularly about how it gives ways to see the world differently by working on the mind. And I've also been intrigued by how some physicists are coming close to Buddhist ideas, although they've started in a very different place. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to explore different interpretations and approaches, both physics and in Buddhist ones, and I'm going to quote pretty extensively from physicists to show the similarities between the two approaches. So, physics has changed a lot over the last 100 years. So let's start by looking at physics 100 years ago. It's much more like common sense then. So we could say then that physics was looking at an objective world, that is, a world that was assumed to exist independent of humans, and aimed to find the laws it followed by observation and experiment. It was very successful, and about 100 years ago, people thought they were close to understanding everything. On the other hand, Buddhism, Buddha, said that we know the world through our senses, so sight, hearing, touch, taste, smell, and the mind, which that mind is sensing ideas and images. And of course, this idea is not unique. Many philosophers also stress the importance of sense experience. The Buddha said that what we know of the mind, know of the world, is dependent on the mind and of the person observing. So our ideas and views are important and will make a difference to what we see. And I notice that because, particularly actually, when I go looking for wild flowers, and I'll go searching through, you know, going walking along a path or something and identify some wildflowers, and as I go along, perhaps find a new one I hadn't seen before and identify it. And then I always see lots of them. It's really fascinating. And I can even go back on the path where I'd been before and see them. And I hadn't seen them before. It's as if I only see what I already know how to recognise. Also, our state of mind makes a difference. So, you know, you may have noticed that when you're driving in a hurry, then there seem to be more red lights and people and other cars seem to be more in the way. And when you're, so when you're in a hurry, likely to experience red lights as an obstruction. Whereas if you're not, it can be an opportunity just to take a short break. It's not the same problem. You don't even notice them as much. So the Buddha was most interested in mind states, and it's illustrated by the first two verses of the Dhammapada. Experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, and produced by mind. If one speaks or acts with an impure mind, suffering follows, even as the cartwheel follows the hoof of the ox. Experiences are preceded by mind, led by mind, and produced by mind. If one speaks or acts with a pure mind, happiness follows, like a shadow that never departs. So physics and Buddhism seem to be very far apart, with different assumptions and different interests. So the ways of viewing reality either as an objective reality or a construct of the mind influence how we go about exploring it. So physicists do experiments, and Buddhists look at what happens in the mind. However, about 100 years ago, there were two important developments in physics that transformed the subject: quantum theory and special and then general relativity. So I'm going to talk a little bit about quantum theory. So since about the 17th century, light had been thought of as a wave because it could be refracted through a prism to give a rainbow like this. And those rainbow colours came from the different frequencies of the light. And it could also display diffraction patterns when waves interfered with each other. Now, the first notable thing that Einstein did was to discover that in some sense, light comes in small packets, which nowadays are called photons. And he was awarded the Nobel Prize in 1921 for that discovery. Now, when light goes through two narrow slits that are close together, then there are interference patterns. If you sort of imagine here that this was like waves on water going through two holes, you'd get sort of waves coming out in semicircles, and they would interfere. So where you get two high points, they'd make an even bigger high point. Where's a high point and a low point, they'd cancel out. So if you do that, and then you have some way of looking at how big the waves are on the right-hand side there, then you get this pattern like this, lots of bars across. And that happens, actually, even when you're looking at light in photons, although it's in little packets, it also makes that kind of interference pattern, as if light's a wave, as in some sense it is. But it happens, you know, physicists thought, oh, well, that's strange. So they tried firing just one photon at a time. And still that pattern came about. So they wondered, what's happening with these photons? What are they doing? So then they decided that they were going to, you can imagine actually, if it were just particles, all you get were, like the right-hand side, two bars like that. You know, it would be quite simple. There were no interference. So it was clear that light was a wave, behaving like a wave. But physicists decided, you know, light's made of photons, so we can observe which slit the photons go through. So they tried doing that. Every time they did it, immediately light started behaving as if it were made of particles. As soon as you could tell which slit the photon was going through, it behaved like a particle. If you didn't look, it behaved like a wave. And in some sense, it was that light, if you look at the mathematics, it's the light is going through both slits, neither slit, the left-hand slit and the right-hand slit, and they're all superimposed. So it's a very sort of strange situation that we can't really imagine. So this is really completely counter to our common sense view of the world, because surely light's either a wave or a particle. And interestingly, the same thing happens with electrons that we think of much more as being little tiny particles. They too have interference patterns and behave like waves. So it became clear that you can't ignore the subject observing the world. The subject, someone observing, makes a difference. Observation makes a difference. And this had a big effect on physicists. So David Bohm said, an object does not have any intrinsic properties, for instance, wave or particle, belonging to itself alone. Instead, it shares all its properties, mutually and indivisibly, with the systems with which it interacts. And these systems include any observers. Another aspect of quantum theory was that small particles, such as electrons, with such small particles, there are limits to what you can observe. So you can only be precise about either position or momentum, but not both. And the more accurately you measure the position of a small particle, like an electron, the less you know about the momentum, and vice versa. There is sort of uncertainty built into the way we observe things. John Wheeler, who's an American physicist who worked on quantum mechanics, said, "Nothing is more important about the quantum principle than this, that it destroys the concept of the world as sitting out there with the observer safely separated from it by a 20-centimetre slab of plate glass. Even to observe as minuscule an object as an electron, he must shatter that glass. He must reach in. He must install his measuring apparatus. It is up to him to decide whether he shall measure position or momentum. To install equipment to measure the one prevents and excludes his installing the equipment to measure the other. Moreover, the measurement changes the state of the electron. The universe never afterwards will be the same. To describe what has happened, one has to cross out the old word observer and put in its place the new word participator. In some strange sense, the universe is a participatory universe." Now, around the time quantum theory was being developed, Einstein came up with the theory of relativity, and there are some elements in common. So, in special relativity, it became clear that what is observed depends on the observer. So, in particular, if you have this situation where there's a rocket travelling past the moon very, very fast, so close to the speed of light, or else you hardly notice it, then if you're on the rocket, you think that the moon has shrunk along the length you're travelling in. If you're on the moon, you think the rocket has shrunk, it looks shorter. So that's odd, isn't it? Different observers see length differently. Also, they see time differently. Time and length are connected, according to relativity. And so you see someone who's travelling as going more slowly than you, and you won't agree on what is simultaneous. Again, this is quite counter to our common sense view. The viewpoint of the observer can't be ignored. So from both quantum theory and special relativity, it became clear to physicists that it's impossible to ignore the observer. And it's brought out in many quotes by eminent physicists. And here are a few examples. So Eugene Wigner, who worked in quantum mechanics and won the Nobel Prize in Physics in 1963. "It will remain remarkable, in whatever way our future concepts may develop, that the very study of the external world led to the scientific conclusion that the content of the consciousness is the ultimate universal reality." Max Planck, major founder of quantum physics, Nobel Prize in Physics in 1918. "Let us get down to bedrock facts, the beginning of every act of knowing, and therefore the starting point of every science, must be in our own personal experience." Then Sir Arthur Eddington, who introduced and explained Einstein's theory of relativity to the English-speaking world. "It is difficult for the matter-of-fact physicist to accept the view that the substratum of everything is of mental character. But no one can deny that mind is the first and most direct thing in our experience, and all else is remote inference. Inference either intuitive or deliberate. And then Werner Heisenberg, again one of the founders of quantum mechanics, Nobel Prize in Physics in 1932. The common division of the world into subject and object, inner world and outer world, body and soul, is no longer adequate and leads us into difficulties. And then Einstein, who created the theory of relativity and contributed to quantum mechanics, although interestingly, he was very uncomfortable with the apparent statistical nature of quantum mechanics. Science is the attempt to make the chaotic diversity of our sense experience correspond to a logically uniform system of thought. The sense experiences are the given subject matter, but the theory that shall interpret them is man-made. It is hypothetical, never completely final, always subject to question and doubt. So the Buddha's emphasis on mind no longer seems at variance with physics. So let's look a bit more at what the Buddha said about the nature of reality. And then we can compare it with similar comments from physicists. The Buddha wasn't interested in metaphysics. So there was a monk who approached the Buddha and complained that he'd not answered certain philosophical questions, whether the world is finite or infinite, whether it's eternal or not eternal, whether the life principle is the same as the body or different from it, and whether the Buddha exists after death or does not exist after death, or both exists and does not exist after death, or neither exists or does not exist after death. Does that remind you of the photons going through the slits? It's the same sort of thing, isn't it? And in answer, the Buddha said, "It's as if there were a man struck by an arrow that was smeared thickly with poison. His friends and companions, his family and relatives would summon a doctor to see the arrow. And the man might say, 'I will not draw out this arrow as long as I do not know the caste of the man by whom I was struck, his name and his family, whether he was tall or short or medium height.' That man would not discover these things, but that man would die." So the Buddha was saying that trying to answer these abstract metaphysical questions is a diversion from what really matters. So I don't think he'd have become a physicist. Instead, the Buddha taught how to be free from suffering. He himself was free from suffering, and he wanted to help others to become free too. And that was his emphasis. He was very pragmatic. His teachings are practical and designed to help. And I'll explore more of this later. Interestingly, Einstein too realised that physics doesn't help with some important facets of life. So he said, "How on earth are you ever going to explain in terms of physics and chemistry so important a biological phenomenon as first love?" So what did the Buddha say about the nature of reality? Well, what I'd like to explore are three characteristics of conditioned existence. And to start, I'm going to just explore a bit what I mean by conditioned existence. The Buddha said that everything arises in dependence on conditions and cease when those conditions cease. So that applies to things. What he means is, you know, the Buddhist center is here because of all sorts of physical conditions. There's the building here, electricity gives light, water, gas. People contribute to the upkeep. There's teaching, befriending. In a society where such institutions are allowed and even valued, all these conditions help to make it exist. also applies to mental states. So let's take the example of feeling stressed. And there can be lots of conditions which can contribute to feeling stressed, like tiredness, feeling lack of control, insomnia, and such like. And these things don't just happen on their own, they actually interact with each other. So the diagram really looks much more like this. Lots of conditions, quite complex, interacting. So when you're feeling stressed, you're likely to suffer more from insomnia, that's likely to give you a fit, be tired, like to feel less in control, and so on. So things don't happen randomly, but because of a complex array of causes. And this, of course, is a basis of physics too. And furthermore, these causes and conditions are complex and affect each other. So the Buddha said we can never understand all the conditions that give rise to something. Compare this to Heisenberg, one of the founders of quantum theory, who said, "The world thus appears as a complicated tissue of events in which connections of different kinds alternate or overlap or combine and thereby determine the texture of the whole." So conditioned existence, you can see, is all the things around us, our mental states and such like. And there are three characteristics of such things: that all conditioned things are impermanent, all conditioned things are unsatisfactory, and all things are devoid of unchanging selfhood. And the Buddha was particularly interested in how these characteristics apply to us. And this emphasis is not irrelevant to science. As Max Planck said, "Science cannot solve the ultimate mystery of nature, because in the last analysis, we ourselves are part of the mystery we're trying to solve." So the Buddha was exploring the mystery of being human. So let's look at this first characteristic. All conditioned things are impermanent. So in our examples, the Buddhist center here is constantly changing. As people come and go, are more or less involved, the seasons change, the theater here gets decorated, temperature changes. It isn't the same from one moment to the next. And similarly with stress. It can cause a sleepless night leading to greater feelings of stress, or you can take some exercise or go for a walk in the country and feel refreshed, or someone smiles at you, or you have a cup of tea and feelings change. Again, it's never the same from one moment to the next. There is nothing but change. Not things that change, but just change, a process, a flow. And this is the meaning of impermanence. And you can easily see it if you have a garden, which I do, and I enjoy going round because every day it's different. There are hourly changes, so the dew will evaporate. Daily changes as flowers open, birds come and go. Changes through the seasons. Yearly changes as plants grow or die back. And it can just be a delight to experience all that. But we can easily assume things as more permanent than they are. And I realised my own assumptions about permanence once when I was talking to Ruth Raketu about fearing about getting old and no longer being able to teach here at the Buddhist Centre, as I do now. And he pointed out that when that happens, I probably won't feel the same way about teaching as I do now. Actually, I'm likely to change. And I'd assumed I was going to feel the same way then as I do now. So it really brought it home to me, my own assumptions. So Buddha was teaching all material things, all aspects of our experience are impermanent. Second characteristic is all conditioned things are unsatisfactory. You learn that quite early on. The word translated as unsatisfactory is a Pali word, dukkha, and it's not easy to translate. It's sometimes translated as suffering, but that really is a bit too strong. It has the connotation of a badly fitting axle wheel that just sort of jolts us along in life. And life contains dukkha because of sickness, old age, death, and we don't always get what we want. So we're not making a mistake if we find life difficult sometimes. On the other hand, there's a possibility of freedom from dukkha if we can accept what can't be changed. On the other hand, the transitory nature of things can lead to dukkha if we fight against that change. There's a story from the time of the Buddha that illustrates the nature of impermanence and suffering and how the Buddha taught about them. So let's imagine ourselves 2,500 years ago in northern India, and the Buddha had left his wealthy and powerful family and gone wandering in order to learn how to transcend dukkha. There was a tradition at the time of people leaving the normal responsibilities of family and becoming spiritual seekers, wandering and living off alms. And after 7 years of practice, some with teachers, some alone, and some with others practicing austerities, the Buddha sat under a Bodhi tree all night and gained enlightenment, the freedom he sought. And the Buddha then went out wandering through northern India, meditating and teaching, and helped many others too to gain that freedom from suffering. And one such woman was Kisa Gotami. She came from a poor family and was frail and thin, and had married a prosperous man, and his family looked down on her. But she had a son and gained some respect in the family. Then her husband died, and the boy became her lifeline. But when he was about 2 years old, the boy became sick and died. And Kisa Gotami was overwhelmed with grief and refused to accept what had happened. She put the child on her hip and went from door to door asking for medicine for the child. And people said, "What use is medicine?" Not surprising, really, as the child was dead. Eventually, someone took pity and suggested she go to see the Buddha. She went to the Buddha and asked him for medicine to cure her child. The Buddha agreed and said he needed one ingredient, a mustard seed from a house in which nobody had died. So Kisa Gotami went from house to house asking for mustard seed. Everyone was happy to help, but in every house many people had died, and people told her about them. Gradually, Kisa Gotami realized that what had happened to her was not a unique stroke of bad luck. She took her son to a charnel ground and sang a verse. "No village law is this, no city law, no law for this clan or for that alone. For the whole world, and even for the gods in heaven, this is the truth. Everything is impermanent." Then she went back to the Buddha, who asked if she'd brought the mustard seed, and she replied, "The little mustard seed has done its work." And Kisa Gotami asked the Buddha to accept her as a disciple. He did, and she went on to become enlightened. And as she expressed it, "I, even I, am healed of my hurt. Low is my burden laid, my task is done. My heart is wholly set at liberty." So let's explore this story a bit. The Buddha helped Kisa Gotami to discover for herself the nature of reality as impermanent and unsatisfactory, not by being told, he didn't preach, but engaged her in a process whereby she discovered it for herself. impermanence needs to be understood deeply, not as an abstract intellectual truth. And similarly, we need to understand dukkha. Our life will not always conform to our wishes. We may not always be able to change external events, but we can change our relationship to them. When we understand impermanence and dukkha, it can bring relief and a sense of freedom. Let me tell you about one experience I had a couple of months ago of just viewing an experience differently and therefore experiencing it differently. I got to the station to catch a train, and the way Cambridge Station is now, when you've got a bike, you need to go up in a lift and go across sometimes to get to a platform on the other side, as my train was on one of the platforms I couldn't reach. And the lift was out of order, so I couldn't catch the train, and I missed the train. And I noticed that what happened was immediately I felt quite angry, and I started sort of composing an email in my mind about, you know, how it shouldn't be like this. And then I realised that actually this was really unpleasant, and I was feeling hungry because it was lunchtime, and there were plenty of places on the station selling food, so I could go and get myself some lunch, sit down and enjoy my lunch, which was what I did. So it could, you know, the same experience of missing that train could be experienced in different ways. And actually, it was interesting, as I was enjoying my lunch, I just felt grateful that I was in a place where there was plentiful food. You know, it's not like that everywhere in the world when things happen. So I just felt some gratitude. So we've explored two characteristics, how conditioned things are impermanent and unsatisfactory, and how those two, in a way, are quite related. Now let's explore the third one. All things are devoid of unchanging selfhood. So many seekers in the Buddha's day conceived of spiritual quest in terms of the search for the imperishable essence of who we are. But according to the Buddha, there is no imperishable essence, as there was just an existence, a flow of mind states and physical states, a process of becoming. The self, like everything else, is a process. Furthermore, that self is not independent and separate from others. It isn't that the self is completely non-existent. It's rather a matter of undermining our habit of thinking of ourselves as a fixed and separate identity. So first let's look again at this impermanence. We aren't always aware of changes, as some happen quite slowly. But, you know, you do notice as you're getting older how the body changes, becoming fatter or thinner. I sort of notice how I always think of my grandparents as being old. I always think of my grandchildren as being young, and sort of had it quite hard to imagine grandparents being young and my grandchildren being old. I've got many faces here of Aung San Suu Kyi, and, you know, there she is, sometimes young, sometimes old, sometimes smiling, sometimes quite serious. Which one is the true person? There isn't one. She changes just like everyone else. It's quite interesting if you try to construct a family tree and put a photo of each person. You know, what age do you choose? Also, our roles change. You know, from child, student, worker, parent, musician, sports player. And yet we can use the current one to define ourselves. And I remember when I retired how I just felt like a nobody. And it was very interesting. Actually, it felt like a relief not to be somebody, to be a nobody. other changes happen more quickly, and yet we can still find it hard to remember the truth of change. So, you know, you're feeling down or you're feeling happy. It's so easy to think it will last forever. Become caught up in a particular thought and don't see how you can think differently in a day or a week or a year. And sometimes we don't question and assume likes and dislikes will stay the same, as my previous story, really. So we may continue watching a TV program out of habit, and we perhaps don't notice we no longer enjoy it. Or when we've enjoyed something, we try repeating that experience. But actually, when you come to the second and third piece of chocolate cake, it just doesn't taste the same. So now let's look a bit at not being separate. Realisation of that came for me once on a solitary retreat. It's the first solitary I'd done, and it was the middle of winter. And I was in a place which had no phone, really shut away from the world. And there was a power cut. The place was completely dependent on electricity for lighting, cooking, heating, everything. And suddenly I realised that although I'd shut myself away from the world, I was still dependent on a lot of other people. And I had to go and phone and just check everything was all right, and the power came back on. The Buddha tells a story that further illustrates our dependence on each other. So he told the story of a bamboo acrobat who set up his pole and climbed up and balanced carefully, and invited his assistant to join him and said to her, "You look after my balance and I'll look after yours. With us looking after one another, we'll show off our craft, receive payment, and safely climb down the bamboo pole." And the assistant replied, "No, master, that won't do. You must look after your balance and I'll look after my balance. With each of us looking after and protecting ourselves, we'll show off our craft, receive payment, and safely climb down the bamboo pole." The Buddha said she was right, and looking after ourselves is important. And he goes on to say, "Looking after oneself, one looks after others. Looking after others, one looks after oneself. How does one look after others? By looking after oneself. By practicing mindfulness, developing it, and making it grow. How does one look after oneself? By looking after others. By patience, non-harming, loving-kindness, and caring." So notice how the boundaries between what looking after oneself and the other disappeared. By taking time and space to practice mindfulness and become aware of what's happening in our own experience, we're also looking after others. And by showing kindness and care for others, we're also being kind and taking care of ourselves. So remember, the Buddha's saying that the self is impermanent and separate. That's what he means, they're saying it's not self. So material things we think of as ours are only around for a while. Many thoughts come from others, from family and friends, what we read, hear on TV and so on. Feelings can be picked up from others, those we're close to. You may have found you can pick up a mood from someone close to you. And the way we influence each other it's often described by the image of Indra's net, which is sort of like a net with a jewel in each person being like a jewel which reflects everyone else. So since all aspects of ourselves are transitory and we're not independent of others, our sense of self is not in line with reality. It leads us to focus too much on ourselves rather than others. And it can lead to frustration, as the rest of the world doesn't care as much about us as we do about ourselves. Now, you may think this discussion of self is far from physics. But although he wasn't a Buddhist, Einstein seems to express many things close to the Buddha. And this is one of them. The true value of a human being is determined primarily by the measure and the sense in which he has attained to liberation from the self. So let me just repeat that. The true value of a human being is determined primarily by the measure and the sense in which he's attained to liberation from the self. So how do we attain this liberation from the self? Well, the Buddha provided a threefold path of ethics, meditation, and wisdom. So ethics, the basis of ethics is kindly feelings and well-wishing. It involves generosity, in some ways the most basic ethical action. It involves kind acts, involves speaking the truth. And all these involve acting as if you're less self-centered. And then meditation. Meditation is a direct way of working with the mind. And the mind, as I've said, is central to the way we experience the world. And remember the two aspects to meditation, mindfulness and cultivating kindness. And they correspond to the Buddha's advice to the bamboo acrobat. Practicing mindfulness, so more aware of what's happening in experience, so we're better able to direct attention where we want it to go, looking after ourselves. And developing loving kindness and caring, not just for others, but also actually for ourselves. And then wisdom. And one way of thinking about wisdom is about developing greater awareness and understanding of the three characteristics of impermanence, dukkha, and that everything is devoid of unchanging selfhood. And that's done primarily by practicing ethics and meditating, but also directly. And I thought I'd give you just a couple of suggestions. So one is appreciating our connection with others. So many people contribute to our well-being, just as, you know, we're here now. So, you know, we've probably eaten today. There are so many people who've contributed to growing the food, selling it, cooking it, providing the water. There are the clothes we're wearing, producing raw materials, making them, selling them, chairs sitting on, electricity, gas, warming the place, lighting and heating. And the basics, like those who taught us to speak and understand, who educated us, those who helped us be healthy. And then it's worth appreciating our common humanity, that we all want to be free from suffering. And that can include those we see regularly and hardly notice, and those in other countries, perhaps very different conditions. And there are many opportunities just to appreciate that everyone is human, so, you know, has the same sort of wishes, just to be happy. And lastly, there's becoming more open to what's actually happening. Seeing impermanence and breaking habits. I'm going to leave you with a quote from Einstein that is a particular favourite of mine and really seems quite close to Buddhism. A human being is part of the whole, called by us the universe, a part limited in time and space. He experiences himself, his thoughts and feelings, as something separated from the rest, a kind of optical delusion of his consciousness. This delusion is a kind of prison for us, restricting us to our personal desires and to affection for a few persons nearest to us. Our task must be to free ourselves from this prison by widening our circle of understanding and compassion to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature in its beauty. And I like that because it brings out how we're not separate. We're part of a whole. And that's how seeing through that delusion, so gaining wisdom, also leads to compassion. So I think it's very interesting, that link between wisdom and compassion. And it gives us something to do. It's again, just like the Buddha, it's quite pragmatic about trying to see this widening circle. And it's so wise, I'm just going to say it again to finish off. A human being is a part of the whole, called by us the universe, a part limited in time and space. He experiences himself, his thoughts and feelings, as something separated from the rest, a kind of optical delusion of his consciousness. This delusion is a kind of prison for us, restricting us to our personal desires and to affection for a few persons nearest to us. Our task must be to free ourselves from this prison by widening our circle of understanding and compassion to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature in its beauty. Thank you.